So in Judaism, as we mentioned, life is of utmost importance, that the Torah puts a tremendous value on human life. And save three exceptions to three cardinal sins of if someone puts a gun to your head and says, worship idols, or commit adultery, or kill someone else, basically your life takes precedence. Whether it's desecrating the Shabbos, eating not kosher, whatever, everything's thrown off because human life, because you have to be alive in order to be able to serve God.
Or even respecting the dead takes precedent.
Yeah, correct.
Right? Because I remember when my husband died on Shabbos, Rabbi Eisenstein said, you go home from, take a cab from the hospital, and you start phoning your friends and relatives so that they will have respect and be able to come to the funeral on Sunday.
Oh, he said that?
He said that.
Yeah,
I was like, I was shocked. That's what he told my son. My son came over to the shul because my husband died at McMaster. Paul walked over, and we were just finishing up the services. And Rabbi Eisenstein says, tell your mom and your sister, take a cab home. Phoning up, even though it's Shabbos.
Right.
So people will know
To go home is funny. I didn't know you could actually, I thought you wait until after. Unless it was a case where maybe it was summertime and maybe Shabbos would have been ten o'clock. Right, yeah. Then there's what to talk about, right.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that, right, then you get into the details of how far, but right,
yeah.
Human life and respect for dead, takes tremendous, it's called like covet habrias, human dignity. That takes, we see how much respect for the dead, how much more so, some people like respecting the dead, they forget you have to respect the living also. But, if you see the Torah put so much value on respecting the dead, how much more so when someone's alive, right. So, we know, and in fact, and that's why it's a tremendous issue when there's someone, a loved one who's very sick, and let's say terminally ill, and, based on, you can always hope for a miracle, but based on medical science, basically there's no cure. And basically, the only thing the doctors could do is they could just prolong life. The hypothetical case we're talking about, which unfortunately many real cases, is someone who's terminally ill. There's no modern medicine around. There's no cure for the sickness. You're in tremendous pain. And the only thing the medication could do is prolong your life, but it can't make you better. So the Torah obligate you to prolong your life in that situation? Do we say no matter what, one has to extend their life? Or are there ever situations in Judaism where do we say there's a time where perhaps death is preferable to a life of pain? So that's the question. A very, serious question. Is there ever a time in Jewish law where we recognize that maybe you're better off being dead than alive? So just before I give the answer to that, I might as well give you some background information. It's an interesting Gemara in Sota. There was a story, I'm not sure, whether to take it literally or not, but there was a city called Luz, L-U-Z, and it said that you live forever if you're in the city of Luz. However, the Gemara continues and says that when people got older and their life became intolerable and they were in too much pain, they used to walk out of the city and then die. So what's the Gemara telling us? Is the Gemara telling us that there's a time where a person's permitted, at least definitely not directly, but are there ever times indirectly where you could hasten your own death? From that Gemara, it seems to be something to talk about. On the other hand, we know that let's say someone's in a serious accident on Shabbos. He's walking across the street and he gets hit by a big truck. And basically, there are five doctors on the scene. He has to look 5 more minutes. He's alive right now. He's covered all up and they can't even move him. They're trying to get move the truck, whatever it was. And they know basically he has 5 more minutes to live, a half an hour to live. So we say you do everything you can. In other words, we don't say because the person's going to only live 5 more minutes, 5 more hours, it doesn't make a difference. You have to do everything you can possible to try to save that person. So on the other hand, we see even 1 moment of life seems very significant. To keep a person alive for 1 minute, We throw out all the halaws and you desecrate Shabbos, you do everything just to keep a person alive for 5 more minutes. That implies...
Even if you know there's absolutely no chance of saving.
Correct. Even you have an obligation to continue doing whatever you can to try to take off the... You know, if a building... The Gemara's case is a building fell down and they have debris and they're trying to get him off and they realize he's finished. So they said it doesn't make a difference. For, you know, of course the fact is we never know anything for sure. But basically, even based on the facts, it doesn't make a difference. Every moment of life is significant, and therefore you have to do everything you can to save a person.
I understand that concept, but what about if you're causing them discomfort? I mean,
causing the
CPR
person...
CPR can be very painful on the person that it's being conducted on.
But what's the difference? Well, what's going to happen? Right now, No, right now you just that's a separate. Here's a case where basically the building fell down. Here you're taking the bricks off them. You're not, if anything, you're making it more comfortable. We're saying you're allowed to make. We don't just say okay, forget about them. It's 5 more minutes. You're allowed to make life more comfortable. We're not talking about a case where you're making it more difficult. Is you take a guy as you know, 50-pound brick on top of you want to take it off or whatever. You know, you want to take the machines and whatever they do and remove it. That's a separate case we'll get to. You're saying in a case where a person...
That's prolonging death. You know what I mean? Well, often when they give CPR, if someone's dying of cancer and they know the heart is going to stop, and you're always faced with the question, when the heart stops, do we perform CPR?
Yeah, he's going to get to that.
Yeah.
Right, that's right. That's
right.
Right, we're going to come to that issue, right. So therefore, we see on one hand, so what is it? So on one hand, we find things that imply that that every second counts. On the other hand, to prolong life, you know, we say, on one hand, you're allowed to leave the city of Luz. On the other hand, not. In fact, like even we have cases like who decides? Like, let's say someone is sick. Let's say we know the Talmud tells us, the Gemara tells us. Let's say a person is sick on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, a fast day, and a person feels he has to eat. He just feels very sick. He has a bad feeling. You know what? I feel like I'm going to die. I'm going to get sick if I don't eat. And you have 100 doctors telling him, don't worry, you're fine. The Jewish law says he eats. Because they quote a pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Moras. A person knows his own suffering more than anyone else knows it. And if you feel you have to eat, even if the doctors say no, it doesn't make... See, on the other hand, we're strict. If you say not to eat, the doctors say yes, we tell you you have to eat. We go strict in terms of your own health and life. So, therefore, there are certain times we see where it is up to the patient. It can play some input in the decision. On the other hand, we know we don't have complete jurisdiction. We can't commit suicide. I can't go ahead and cut off my... Not that I plan on doing it, but I can't go ahead and cut off my fingers because, on one hand, God gave me a gift, a body to use, not to abuse. So we have to use it in a certain way. So therefore, we have the body, so to speak, it's a gift on loan, and God gives us the body to use. So we can't abuse it either. So certain limitations that we can't do, but as we'll see, there is some room for the patient or the people who, you know, let's say the patient can't decide on their own, they're not capable, for the parents, children, whatever the case is, there will be some flexibility in terms of certain times of taking. And we'll see the difference between, you know, can you withhold medication and, you know, as opposed to withholding other issues. So there's a whole discussion, actually it's a story in Navi. There was a terrible king called Yeravam ben Nevat. He was one of the evil kings. And his son got very sick. His son's name was Avia. He was very sick. Probably we will call him terminally ill. Actually, they weren't sure yet, but he was very sick. And what happened was he had his wife. See, during that day, there were two kingdoms. There were the 10 tribes, and then there were two tribes. And they were fighting with each other. So there was a prophet on the other kingdom, so he had his wife disguise herself and dress up and take a chance, risking their life and embarrassment, and to go to the prophet and ask, what's going to be with my son? And the prophet told her, the moment you put your feet come back into your hometown, your son's going to die. And what happened was, she ended up going back, and the child died. So the question is, did she do the right thing? Number one is, we're talking about someone who was a wicked's wife. So, but how does halacha, Jewish law, are you permitted, if you know, see, what is the implication of the prophet? Obviously, we don't have prophets today, so we have to make a more comparable case. But in the case of a prophet, you know it's going to happen. So, and it, the implications was, if she took 10 years to go home, the son could have lived another 10 years. Yet, so, forget about even the halachic aspect, just the mother for a child. How could a mother hasten the death of their own child? In fact, there's a famous story, one of the great rabbis, the Brisker Rav, he was the Rav Soloveitchik in one of the towns in Europe, I guess Brisk. And there was a case, I guess there was, a person was put in jail by the Gentile authorities, the non-Jewish authorities, and they said, you know, I guess they give you, like, you get the priest to come, so you have a rabbi you want to come to see before we kill you. So he said, yeah, I want the Brisker Rav to come. So the agent came to summon him, he refused to go. They came 2, 3, 4 times, he refused to go. So one of his students spilled up the guts, asked him, but Rebbe, a dying man, you can't fulfill his last request? He said, are you kidding? It's prohibited for me to go, because I know the minute I step into that jail, or the minute I leave that jail, they're going to kill him. So I'll be responsible for hastening his death. So the Brisker Rav felt he wasn't even allowed to go to this. He would have loved to see the person, but he realized that him going into the jail cell would have hastened the... That's the issue here, was your Ravim's wife. So that was the issue. We don't know for sure, but we know medication says, based on modern medicine, we have no cure for it. So we see she felt that the pain was so great. So what... What are we willing to do? We're willing to take medicine and pains and give it to our loved ones if at least there's a hope for some light at the end of the tunnel. But what happens, like, she knew there was no light. He was going to die. And in the case of a terminal ill person, there is no light. So then are you permitted now to try to, so to speak, hasten? You know, it wasn't like she went ahead and took a gun and killed him. She was, this happened, obviously, indirectly by her walking home. She was indirectly causing her death. So what is the story? So basically it comes down to, again, what is better? Is a life of pain better, preferable, or is death preferable? So actually I'm going to give you sources from both sides, and then we'll come up with some type of compromise. So in fact, there's, the famous doctor, Kevorkian. He was, you know, he started off being a nutcase, and now he's, you know, he's like a folk hero. In other words, so what does he do? You know, basically that's the kind of stuff he's mercy killing. He feels he's doing a mitzvah. He's killing, he's taking these people away. So that already, that's clear. You can't, he's actively going ahead and killing some, and that you can't do. But the concept of maybe he got it right, maybe death is better, you definitely can't, murder someone to do it, but the concept maybe is right. So, There's an interesting story. It is actually making fun of doctors. There's a saying in the Talmud. It says, the best of doctors go to Gehenna, go to hell, so to speak. Obviously, you have to learn it in context. What it means to say is, they think of, you know, if you think,
lawyers.
I guess they changed it to, no, there's a lot of lawyer jokes, but especially when you read Alan Dershowitz, he gives you all the lawyers jokes against him. So, you know, it obviously means if he feels he's the one doing it, he doesn't recognize, but whatever the context is, but taken out of context, it means the best of the doctors go to hell. So he says a story, this is a true story. I mean, this rabbi lived about 100 years ago, or Isaac Harif, the name's not important. He was very sick, and the doctor basically said, that's it, you're going to die in the next couple of hours, next day. Whatever. A week or two later, well, somehow he got better. So a week or two later, he's walking on the street, he sees the doctor, like, the doctor sees him, so he crosses over the street. He's embarrassed, like, to even look at him. I told him that he's going to die, and, you know, he's walking. So he runs after him. He says, oh, what, you don't have to, you were right, you don't have to run away from me. What do you mean? Yeah, I was up, because you're right, I went up to heaven, he tells the guy, I went up to heaven, and you know what? I was, you know, among other things going on, I saw this line, and it had this distinguished looking people wearing white robes on, and it was a door to hell, and you were on that list, you were on that line. But I told God, I said, wait a second, no, he's not a doctor. Doctors try to heal people. They don't tell people they're going to die. As the Torah says, it gives permission for a doctor to heal. Doctor doesn't have the permission to kill. So the point being is, so it's an interesting Gemara. So we'll start off with the opinion that says one moment of life is greater, even with any amount of pain, is greater than death. As it says in the chapters of our fathers, Yafesh, it says, is greater as 1 minute of life of doing good deeds in this world than the whole next world. In other words, it's of infinite value. You can never say 1 minute of life is not worth it. It's worth everything. And in fact, what's a proof? A proof, he says, is if someone's dying and he has 5 minutes to live and it's Shabbos, you're allowed to desecrate Shabbos to save his life. If it's better off being dead, then how could you, we're not doing him a favor, how could you violate Shabbos and make it worse? It must be from the fact we permit you to violate, we're saying it's, he's better to be alive. And then in fact, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, one of the great rabbis who lived in Israel, in the Mir Yeshiva, he brings a proof, an interesting proof from a medrash. There's a famous medrash that there were three advisors to Paro. When Paro said, you know, let's solve the Jewish problem in Egypt, what should we do with them? So there were three advisors. There was Bilam, he was a person later on in the Torah, Bilam, Yisro, who was Moses' father-in-law, and Eov. We know Job, the one who's known for suffering. So they say each one got rewarded and punished according to their advice. Bilam said, kill the Jews. He was killed by the sword later on. Yisro ran away when Paro said, what should we do? He said, I want no part of this. He gave up a prominent position in Egypt. His children became a prominent position on the Jewish courts. And Eov, who just sat there silently, he was punished with a life of suffering. So I understand the first two. Like, I see the Midah Kenegdah. I see he said, kill the Jews. He was killed. I see he gave up a prominent position. He got rewarded. But where is the connection, being silent and living a life of pain? So the example I give is basically, let's say you're in a shower. You're taking a shower, and, you know, once in a while, all of a sudden someone turns just the sink or this and that, and all of a sudden the water becomes boiling, and you just scream, ah, and you just jump out, or whatever, you shut it off, whatever you want to do. So does the screaming make the burn on your back better? Of course not. But if it hurts, you scream. If you see other people in pain, you have to protest. It's true EO wouldn't have been successful. They wouldn't have listened to him. But you can't sit by idly when the Jewish people... You have to make... Because as I always point out, the two parts to a protest. Let's say it's a rally for Israel, a rally for Soviet Jews, whatever they used to have. So there's two. One aspect is you want to make the situation better in Israel, better in Russia, whatever we're doing. But that's one part. But no matter what, ultimately you're doing it for yourself. You're the biggest winner. If you see an act of injustice going on in the world and you speak out, you do something good, so the impact on you is worth the event by itself. Of course, we hope to get the second aspect. So by fact, Eov could sit by and not feel the suffering of the Jewish people. That's why he was punished. But what do we see from this measure? Who was worse? It was clearly Bilam is worse than Eov. Bilam said, kill the Jews. Eov didn't say anything. So obviously the one, it's like, obviously Hitler was worse than the Germans who were just sitting there doing nothing. They're responsible also to a certain extent, but they're not as bad as the ones who actually did the killing. So, you know, Bilam was definitely worse. And yet, so what was his punishment? Death. Eov wasn't as bad, he had to live a life of pain. So we see from here, a life of pain is better than death, because Bilam was much worse, and he got the worst punishment. So we see, according to one school of thought is, no matter what you want to say about pain, if you could do it, a life of pain, the fact that what you could do in 1 minute of life is inherent value. So it seems to be clear cut that basically we can never do anything not to prolong our life. However, it's not that simple. There's another Gemara in the which seems to imply the opposite. There's a famous Gemara in Ksuvis about the great Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was the prince, he was the one who wrote the Mishnayos, the oral law. The Mishnah, that was written by this great rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And what happened was, is unfortunately, unfortunately in Jewish history, a lot of suffering. He was being killed by the Romans or some other, I think it was the Romans. And not only were they killing him, but they were torturing him. They wrapped him up in a Sefer Torah, and they put like wet wool. And what I'm not going to go is get into the graphics of it. That's Rav Chananya ben Trad. I'm going to come back to that Gemara in a second. Before I get to that Gemara, just one more before that. The story with Rebbe was he was in tremendous pain. He was terminally ill, and originally Amsa the Rebbe, Rebbe's maidservant, was a great woman. And originally she was praying that with the students that he should get better. But she saw the Gemara goes into graphic details, we don't have to go into it. It's tremendous pain and suffering. She said, why am I praying that he should live? But the students didn't want to listen to her. So the students were praying that he stayed alive, so he stayed alive. So she went up on top of the roof. She took like a big bottle. She threw it off the roof and made a big loud noise. What do kids do? You run out to the window to see what happened. And she got them to stop praying. And the time they came back, Rebbe passed away. So the commentators say what she did was right. We passing like Amsa the Rebbe. Rebbe's maidservant was right. That Rabbeinu, he had such tremendous pain that it was okay. There's a time where the pain is so great, one does not have an obligation to prolong just a life of pain with no chance of recovery. Just the fact there's no mitzvah in Judaism to make the Guinness World of Records. I live to 200, being on all the pipes, and that's not what life is all about. Life is you're able to function and do things and do good deeds.
This is more like prolonging death by adding all these tubes and
So I'm going to get to the details. Right. So therefore they point out, in fact, they say unbelievable is not only don't you have to prolong the suffering, but there's a mitzvah even to pray for his death. In other words, you can't actively kill anyone, but you're allowed to, in fact, it might even be preferable, according to some, if the pain is so bad, you have a right to be, because you're not doing it, you're just praying, God, have mercy, because ultimately, whatever God decides, he's going to do it. You're allowed to pray even, however, they point out, it shouldn't be someone too close to the scene, because we're all humans, we all have some biases, and we might be doing it if it's a real close loved one, and maybe with this feeling, it's too much for us, and we're doing it for the wrong reason. So if you're too close, you shouldn't be the one doing it because you need someone who's objective. But in a situation where it's objectively, it's terrible, it's terminal illness, terminally ill, tremendous pain, there are situations where you're permitted, and it's even a mitzvah to pray that the person die and stop the pain. In fact, the paraphrase what it says in Kaheles, one of the books from Shlomo, there's a eis l'ledes ve'eis l'mus. There's a time of birth, there's a time of life, and there's a time of death. And some learn, what do you mean there's a time of death? When life becomes so intolerable, unbearable, that the pain is so bad, well, we should know from such pain that then there's a time where Jewish law recognizes you do not have to take every step available to prolong just a life of pain. So on one hand, we have every moment of life counts, and you have to do everything. On the other hand, we see Rabbeinu HaKodesh didn't do it. So the basic differences, as we're pointing out, is it depends what status. In other words, a person who's in a coma and basically they're not really functioning. So then the whole point is, Jafashal, you could do something. It's not, as we said, not just to be medically alive. There's no point just to be functioning alive if you can't do anything. So then you don't necessarily have to take all, again, in other words, is withholding, one is permitted to withhold medical treatment. Let me point out, however, one may never withhold oxygen and food. In other words, that's no different than, I mean, emotionally it's very different, but it's like saying, I'm not going to give a 3-month-old baby any food and they're going to die. Obviously, but the basic necessities of life always have to be given. You have to give them, whatever it is, through the tubes, feeding and oxygen, you got to give the basics. But any heroic efforts, that you do not have to do. In fact, that's what Gemara was telling you, Rav Chananya's story with Rav Chananya ben Trajon, that they took the Sefer Torah and they were burning him up. So there seems to be a contradiction from the beginning of the story to the end of the story. What happened was, so they were put the wet cloth on, and they wrapped them up, and they wanted them to suffer more. So he told the Roman soldier, you know, do me a favor, take off the wet cloth and make the fire hotter so I could die sooner, and I guarantee you, you'll get reward in the next world. And for whatever reason, the Roman soldier listened to him. So we see, he didn't do it himself, but he told someone else, you can hasten my death. I always imagine the guy standing in a fire, Bert, imagine the pain he's in. But yet the end of the story seems to contradict it. The end of the story says, and when the students came, they saw the Rebbe burning to death. They said, Rebbe, however the scientists work, but they basically said is, if you either open your mouth or close your mouth, let the smoke get in. They gave the Rebbe an advice how you could die quicker. And he said, God forbid. He said, God gave me life. Only God could take it away. I'm not going to do anything to hasten my own death. So in the same Gemara, you seem to have a contradiction. On one hand, you see this tension in this, because it's a very tough question. You see that on one hand, he told the Roman soldiers to go ahead and do it. And one can make a distinction between you yourself doing it to yourself, and then someone else do, maybe Ben Noach and Anju. But it's a very difficult question in the commentators. And the bottom line is like this, is what we're saying is the ideal in the ideal world. Let me just put halacha in general. When I say Jewish law, people have the impression that when Jewish law says you have to do X, Y, and Z, they're telling you the maximum. It's the opposite. Jewish law is the minimum. And that's why some people are more strict, less strict, but Jewish law is the minimum. In other words, let's say you have to keep Shabbos. How you keep Shabbos, you might have a discussion what's good, what isn't good. You want to be strict. So you have details within a law. You want to be kosher, you have to be kosher. What is kosher? You can have details in the law. But the halach is the minimum. So what the great rabbis are telling us is this. In an ideal sense, that really, if a person is able to, it's great. If a person is alive, not just in a coma, but you could function, and you're able just to do one more good thing, one more darva tov, if you could live a couple more minutes and do one more good thing, we can't imagine what the impact of one good thing could have on you or on other people. In other words, if you could do it, that is the ideal. But the halakha recognizes that's an ideal, but you can't demand it on someone. There is a time when the pain is so great that you just can't, you just feel you can't do it. And you should. And it says even those who say you do not have to prolong it, but you should still try to talk to the person if they can. You try to encourage the person if they could try to keep on living. But ultimately, if the person feels, in fact, there was a case where they had their children paid a yeshiva to, they should pray for the mother. The mother was suffering, and that she should keep on living. And she told them, no, I want you to stop doing that. I don't want them praying for me. They don't have to pray for me, I'm going to die, but I don't want them praying for me. And she went to the Rav, and the Rav said she has a right to. If she said, I don't want, in other words, because in that sense, that's what that patient who feels the pain, you can't tell them how much pain is, I'm saying, well, Elena, I mean, I had kidney stones and other things, I'm sure it doesn't compare to, these types, and hopefully these are only temporary things, and I know how bad that pain, the disappointment, you just feel that's it, you just rather die already than just go on, especially a pain, that's not going away, and you're not getting any better. That's a tremendous pain. So halacha recognizes that there is a time where we're human, and if the person feels they can't go on, there is that point. Again, never kill someone directly. You can never pull a plug on someone. Not to put them on a machine is fine. Never to pull a plug, you can't take away oxygen and water. The basics of life they always have to have, but you don't have to do things to prolong a life of pain. Because it's based on a Rama. The Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch, there was the modern day equivalent, not the modern day, but the medieval equivalent was, where there's a case where a person was basically living a life of pain, suffering, and there was someone chopping wood outside. And somehow the noise was keeping him from concentrating. He just, He wanted to die, but he just couldn't. And they said, yeah, you got to tell the guy to stop chopping the wood. The noise stopped. And then he... Again, that's totally indirect. There's no medical... It's not like pulling the plug out of a machine. It's totally indirectly. So again, so halacha recognizes the frailties of human beings. One should try to encourage someone to try to, if they could, but it's not for us to judge anyone. Ultimately, if they say they just can't deal with it, you have to accept their request and not, you know, whatever you pray for is your own issue. But in terms of withholding, you know, they have a right to tell you, I don't want you to put me on, assuming it's within our parameters, ultimately it's up to the patient to make that decision. He has a right to. So again, the minimum, there is a type of pain which is too much. But again, in an ideal world, one should try to encourage the person as much as possible. And that's why, in fact, that's what we learn out from getting back to Yeravam ben Nevat's wife, her son. It says, the Navi said, he's going to, see, his family was tremendous, wicked people, and they suffered. But he said, everyone's going to suffer in your family except this one son, because he did one good thing in his... it's an apparent contradiction. One place to go, he did one good thing. What he did was, Yeravam ben Nevat, one of the things he did is, he stopped the Jewish people 3 times a year on Passover, on Sukkot, and on Shavuot. We have a commandment during the temple is up to go and see the temple. Go and visit them, bring sacrifices. So he put guards on the road, he prevented them from going. His son didn't listen to him, which should be no surprise when you tell your kid to do something, he does the opposite. But he not only did his son not listen, he himself went up. So if it's for that one good thing he did, and yet the Gemara elsewhere calls him a tzaddik, and they say, explain, because as the Rambam writes, see, many people don't realize this, the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva writes, you know, we have a scale, you weigh, you know, we all have some mitzvahs, some good things, some bad things, some sins, some mitzvahs, and you know, it doesn't go by, it's not quantitative, we count up, we don't know how much this sin is worth, how much it could be. You could have 25 sins, but you have one davar tov, that outweighs the scale. You know, it's not a matter of, well, we don't know, obviously, God, or else we only focus on what we think are the good ones. So you never know in life if a person can do one more davar tov, it's worth it. Inherently, this one moment of life, you can do one more good deed in your life, that's a tremendous, again, we understand the person could decide he just can't, and that's it, and that's fine, and we accept, you know, it's a terrible amount of suffering, and we realize that we recognize the existence of pain, and it's real, it's not just psychological. But if a person can strive, and then, that, you know, and you know, who knows what for, you know, I mean, we don't have prophets today, no one understands why the suffering, you know, we feel so BC, whether it's loved ones, or, you know, I'm in I work in Shalom Village, in the Jewish nursing home, so I see, you know, you always wonder to yourself, like, why is all the suffering, you know, I mean, it's more of an emotional question, and not that we have any answers. But many times you see, and it's hard for those people involved, I wish there was no pain, they wouldn't have to, but I'm just saying the pain's there. But you see many times families getting together, how much they do for their loved ones at the end, and you never realize how much that affects, you know, the person. And, you know, and a person can do one more good thing. So the point is, one never knows that even you could be a Yeravam ben Nevat's son, but that one good deed could tilt the whole scale. You know, we never have a whole picture. So the bottom line, that's the tension. And of course, it's not in Judaism, nothing black and white. The more you know, you realize a lot of gray. And therefore, you always have that tension. It's easy to choose good versus bad. It's the good versus good. You got to weigh all the priorities.
Rabbi, when you admit someone in Shalom Village, they always put that question to you, what do you want done if someone has cardiac arrest?
Correct.
Very difficult question to ask.
And in fact, right, and just one more thing, right, and you're right, number one is when a doctor asks you that question, number one is I'm not talking Jewishly, a person shouldn't, you don't feel you have to answer that question right away. You need something, maybe things check. A lot of times in panic, doctors also jump the gun. But number one, don't sort of jump and sign anything right away. Think about it together, whoever's making the decision. And just realize this. If you are, you know, assuming if you can decide to go with the DNR order, then you have to realize you have an extra responsibility. Because the reality is that once the nurses see the family is basically given up and say they don't, I'm not saying, you know, what they view as I don't care anymore, the bottom line, even the comfort to the patient, they're not going to change. In other words, it's a different, whether they admit to it or not, in other words, you're going to treat someone who you know. So if you do, if let's say you do and it's warranted, you make sure you're there, or you make sure people, you have an extra responsibility to that person that he's watched over, because once you sign that, you're basically telling, it's an unwritten rule, the nurses know, and basically he's going to be the last one on the list to take care of. So besides the halakhic issues, just pragmatically, you have to, no one never jump to signing anything. That's a good rule in general. Don't make decisions in panic, wherever business you're in. But and if you are going to make that decision, make sure you realize, and you better take on extra responsibility to make sure that the comforts of, that you don't want them to be suffering even more now because of this decision. So that's the tension in Jewish order. Again, you know, and basically you can't, in other words, assuming this parameter, certain things are clear cut. We can't murder. It's a general rule. The rule is we always try to prolong life. And if there is no pain, then there's no reason that we have to. In other words, we're only talking about a very isolated case of terminally ill, a life of pain. If he's terminally ill and there's no pain, then you have to do everything you can also. But it's only talking about a life of pain which is intolerable, then, you know, then we have this, then we have the minimum he doesn't have to, and depending on the, you know, on the level on the person. But it's and we see all the different Gemara, you see the tension in the Talmud and the oral law, you know, struggling with, you know, and the bottom line, there's no right or wrong. In other words, there is, you know, you have to weigh, and ultimately it comes down to individual, how much they want it, how much pain, you know. People have different pain tolerance. Not someone, no one can make a decision for someone else here. It's, you know, it's, that's, you know, there is a personal aspect of that decision as well. As we said, it's like on Yom Kippur, you can have the doctor saying, it's okay, fast, no way. Lev yodea maris nefesh. No one knows better than you. That's if you're feeling, you feel whatever coming on you, no matter, you know, doctors are human also, and they'll tell you, and therefore you have to do, the rule is basically you do everything, under ordinary situations, we say prolong life, do everything possible, keep them alive. Under these special situations of terminal illness and pain, you are not obligated to go to every heroic effort. Just the basic oxygen and that, and if a person, and even to the extent, you can even pray for that person's death if the pain is that bad. So we recognize this tension, and that's the tension. You know, we don't live in an ideal world, and unfortunately there is pain, and we have to balance and try to balance the two, which in general, life is all about balance in general. This is just a more extreme case. Any questions, comments, alternative speeches?
Having gone through that, I know how difficult it is. It's a terrible decision.
Right. I'm saying, I see it all the time now. You see how hard it's... Yeah. Right, I see how hard it is even if the person's not in pain. I just, I know my father-in-law has Alzheimer's, I'm just saying, so, you know, that's like, that's one where it's very hard because, in other words, no one knows anything for sure, but apparently they seem to be not in pain. You know, we get into quality of life. So, who decides what quality of life is? And it's obviously, which shouldn't happen to anyone else, but it could be the equivalent of, a 3-year-old kid playing blocks with his, an Alzheimer's patient could be very happy with to us or a loved one who knew this person as a, it's so sad, you see. But that, obviously, that's unfortunately true. But now he could be, who knows how happy he is. And in fact, I think the worst part, the hardest part of, not for the, for the, I'm talking about for the victim, for the patient, the hardest part probably is when there's a time where you sense you're losing it, like you're still aware, but you feel like you're out of control. That's probably the worst thing. After, once you get a certain point, like, you don't even know.
That's
so,
what I think.
Right.
I've seen, observed that.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Well.
I spoke with someone, one of the nurses told me, we had one of the patients said, I know I'm going, I'm losing, when someone tells you they know, that's the worst feeling, because there's nothing you can do about it.
That's
and you know, if you just lost it, you don't know about it. So, it's a sad situation, but at least it's not a struggle. That's what I always, except for the, all the time, just physically, but, it's going to take an impact, but I'm saying, but ultimately, a person could be very relaxed and happy and live even a longer life. It's kind of like an existence of a child, so to speak, kids, you know, don't worry, you know, it's a different type of stress for kids, but basically go lucky, you're doing what you want. You know, no one wishes it upon anyone, but I'm saying, but it's that we have no right to, because we have no right, no one knows what the person's going through, and that, for them, that's the quality of life. It's sitting, enjoying, smiling, eating something, you know, who am I to determine that's not quality of life? We can't play God on that. That's right. You know, that's what we can't.
That's what I feel, too. Yeah. It's the worst when they realize that their memory is going and they're not acting right. I think that's horrible.
For me, right, that's
But once they're certain, it's just...
I think it's very hard. Once you it's very hard on the kids after that.
Oh,
just seeing your parents like that, that's just a killer. I'm saying in terms of mentally and that. I mean, in terms of that, you know, and, you know, I know because my wife, my father-in-law, because my mother-in-law passed away with cancer, and then, like, right after they diagnosed her, it's almost like two things right away. And now, but a certain sense, at least there's closure on that. Now, like, this can, you know... continue. So again, you know, but you know, who knows, maybe, you know, maybe he's happy now, he's living a comfortable life, but it's so hard for a child to see any, you know, you see any loved one in that situation, you know, it's just so difficult. Right, you know, so hopefully, you know, hopefully he's have some cures for Alzheimer's soon with the...
Is suicide the worst thing?
Right, so in terms of, that's what we touched on last week. On the books, suicide, it's one of the worst, and it says a person who commits suicide loses his portion in the world to come. So let me just point out, so I don't mean like someone who's let's say is living during the Holocaust or is under tremendous pain and suffering and he commits suicide. I'm not saying that's justified, but that's not what we're talking about. What it says, when we say someone who commits suicide, it means it's the theology behind it. In other words, let's say, I always give an example, let's say you have a philosophy professor. Objectively, he has two homes, two cars, he lives a comfortable life, he has a good job, he has good kids. You know, objectively, there's nothing. He develops a philosophy in life, how life is not worth living anymore, and he commits. So basically, that's, in other words, cause what are you doing? Because basically, you're running from the pan to the fire. In Judaism, we believe in the next world. So where you're running from, by you committing suicide, you're showing I don't believe in the next world. So if you don't believe in the next world, you're not going to get it. It's worthy. And also, you can't do tshuva on that. In other words, if you kill someone else, ironically, at least you can have a regret and this and that. And you kill yourself, you know, it's over. But it's kind of like cremation in terms of theology. Like cremation is against Jewish law. So Jewish law, you have to be buried. And even if you took the ashes and buried them in the ground, you wouldn't fulfill your mitzvah of burial, because by definition, once you burn the body is not there, it's something different. But that's just legally, but from a philosophical point of view, theology, the reason why cremation is so bad, again, because it's showing, is basically you're having, it's negating the next world. I'm not saying the person who does cremation is thinking that, I'm not judging, I'm saying the concept of the concept of cremation, someone might do it because they think it's healthier, it's cheaper. I'm not talking about a person. I'm not even talking about any individual. I'm just saying the concept of cremation is you're showing you think it's over, it's kosher, throw my ashes in the water and it's over. So it's a denial of the next world. Then that's why it's so severe. Or suicide, it's a philosophy behind it. It's not the act itself, because it's no different than murdering someone else in terms of it's an act of murder. But it's the theology behind the act. That's why they look at. That's the thing. Today, practically speaking, a suicide victim, a suicide person isn't. We don't view them. You know, we bury them in a Jewish cemetery. We sit shiva.
We recognize
it's a. It's very. In other words, it's almost impossible to have. You know, or it's very. It's you know. It's almost impossible the way the Jewish law sets up suicide that we're going to have it. It's more something. It's just to teach you how bad it is. It's not someone who's under distress and harm, you know.
So after suicide or cremation, there's no coming back for another chance.
Well, I'm saying there's always, in other words, on anything, I wouldn't say there's never a chance. I'm saying, you know, you never, in other words, but I guess suicide is something you could do after that. Could be maybe when you cut your wrist, then the moment before you died, you did shoot, you know what I'm saying? So in other words, the principle is, I'll give you, the Gemara says, what can you do tshuva on, what can you repent on? It says, It's a principle. It says, Ein kategor nasa sanegor. Let's take an example with lawyers. Let's say you can't have a defendant and prosecutor on the same team. Obviously, it's a conflict of interest. So it says, like the Jewish people, in other words, like the Kohen, the high priest doesn't wear gold on the Day of Atonement. We're atoning for the sin of the golden calf, so you're not going to wear gold. So to speak here, in other words, if a person says, you know what, I'm not going to sin now, but you know what, I know there's a concept of tshuva. I know God said tshuva. You know what, I'll go do my sin, and only because it's tshuva that I'll do the sin. So then, that's a case of ein kategor, not, if tshuva is the cause of your sin, then how could tshuva be atonement for your sin? So it's very difficult in a situation like that, but the bottom line is everything, even they did say it's much harder, but there's no state, you know, even if a voice from heaven comes out and says, you can't do tshuva, you ignore, in words, it doesn't make it, we always, in words, we believe there's never, we never say never, no matter how far gone anyone is, you could always, there's always, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, the farther down you go, the harder it's going to be. But there's never, we never say never. Because, you know, there's always hope, basically.
Right. It's kind of like, if the building collapses, somebody's underneath, and they're, you know, it's almost a certain thing, but yet you still try anyways.
Right, no, for sure.
So, I'm not really sure, though, is there like some kind of, in one way, somebody's suffering incredible pain, it's merit to, you know, help them to.
No, right. That's also another concept is also, suffering. You know, the suffering you do in this world, so that's going to make it greater in next world. You know, I don't wish on anyone. You know, we're not on the level where, you know, I mean, in other words, we don't have prophets today to say that this is a punishment for someone. I'm saying a person on their own, that should be their. In other words, if I see someone suffering, he must have did something wrong. That's not, in other words, if a person himself should try to take on an attitude that if he's suffering, try to use it, but if you're viewing someone else, that shouldn't be your view, because we don't have prophets. No one knows. Life is complex. You can never pin on one thing for anything. Anyone who makes a statement like that, you know, it's a ridiculous statement, because we don't have prophets today. No one can say, this happened. We don't have any cause of effect today. I mean, there is, but we don't know what it is. So people say, the Holocaust happened because of that. That's the most, you know, it's a ridiculous statement. It might be, it's true, but that thing was bad, but to say, you know, it's a ridiculous, because we have no clue why it happened. And even if they did, that wouldn't justify a Holocaust, you know, so, but in turn, that is true. We have, pain is a kapara, pain is an atonement. So in that sense, you know, it's a, you know, from a, looking at it from an ideal level, it's like cleansing yourself. If you suffer here, so therefore, you know, whatever it means, the pain is much worse in Gehenna. So therefore, God gives you a little pain here, so therefore, you don't have to suffer it. So that's an aspect also, which is true. Again, you know, that's something a person takes on for himself. Not, we don't view other people that way. In other words, other people you view, you know, nothing to do with the sins. You just, you know, you have mercy and you try to help them. If you want to, you know, a person on their own could take on, it's a good thing, and I'm recommending it. It's a high level, as one should, and that's an extreme case. It doesn't have to, the Chafetz Chaim used to say, the best thing to happen to a person is to get insulted, is to be embarrassed. In other words, you know, a real pain is, you know, your kids get sick, they get hurt, or, you know, real serious things, you lose your job. But the best thing is if you get an insult. Because bottom line, you know, it's embarrassing then, but nothing, that's the best way of getting it. You know, he says that along this concept is, in other words, you should thank you so much, you insult, you know, obviously it's hard to do it when you're getting insulted, but that's a very high level, but that's the attitude one should try to strive for is, you know, that's a great way of, and that's, you know, in a certain sense it's true. Is they say, if you, let's say you stub your toe and you realize that's pain, then let's say, okay, you won't have to break your leg then. You know, I'm just saying, however, I'm not playing God here, but that type of concept, you know, if you appreciate something, so you won't need the next step, assuming that school of thought that, let's say, God gives us pain to atone. So if we get the message early, kind of like we have a concept in the Torah of this leprosy. So if you speak evil gossip about someone, so you get them, you get, you know, it's not really leprosy, but it's the equivalent of leprosy. So there's a concept where it comes on a house first. So the first it says, first it comes on, dots come on the house, then it comes on the clothes. Kind of it's like a warning. In other words, that if you still don't get it, then it comes, kind of like Noah with the flood. That Noah said, for 120 years, he's telling people it's going to come, change. And no one listened. And then it started slowly drizzling and raining and pouring. You know, you try to give the person as much time. Just to conclude, that's what's interesting. We were introduced to Avram Avinu in Parashas Lech Lecha. So what's the first thing we're introduced in the written law? It says, Lech Lecha, go leave your homeland and go to the land of Israel. So we know at the end of Parashas Noach, it talks about Or Kasdim. That was the name of a town. And the Medrash tells, you know what happened in Or Kasdim? Avram was willing to, one of the evil kings, Nimrod, said, either you worship idols or I'm going to kill you. So he jumped into the fiery furnace, and a miracle happened, and he lived. And that's an instant Avram was willing to sacrifice his life in order for the sake of God. So the question is, if we're beginning, if a first meeting with Avram will make more sense, it would have made more sense. Have the Torah tell me, you know what character Avram Avinu has? Look what he's willing to do. He's willing to jump into a fiery furnace. And yet, it seems it starts with a seemingly trivial thing of Lech Lecha, go leave your hometown. So what? Why not? So many answers, but one answer along the lines we're talking is to teach us a very important lesson that Judaism is a religion of life, not a religion of death. In other words, and we see the problem in some other sects that when there's too much of an overemphasis on the next world, you end up negating this world. You become suicide bombers. In other words, The Torah was concerned if we introduce you, Avram, as someone who was willing to jump in, but something even greater than dying for God is living for God, is living a life of sanctifying God. And that's the message of the Torah is. Torah is a living Torah, and that's why, in fact, you'll find no mention explicitly in the written law about Olam Haba, about the next world. It's a belief you have to believe in. The Maimonides says it's one of the 13. But again, for the same reason, yeah, it is important. But we don't overemphasize the next world. You negate this world. God gave us this world to live in, and where you're going to be sitting in the next world, in the bleachers or in the front row, depends on what you do in this world. And we see that's the problem of other religions. When you put out too much emphasis on the next world, you don't, you know, and the Torah realized that. So we don't start with Or Kasdim, because you might get the wrong impression. But it's Lech Lecha. Go ahead now. You're about to go live a life, and go ahead and spread ethical mind. That's what Judaism is all about. It's a living religion, not a religion of death.
And how much you really know of the world to come. Like, that's a whole interesting subject.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, very.
Right.
So you were using the word sect, but that's just like your choice of words, or
I'm just saying, or whatever, or nation, or whatever. You know, I guess we all know who we're talking about,
right?
But I'm just saying, you know, whatever. You know, obviously, among the Muslims, there's a big problem there. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the major issues is. That, you know, they're telling these little kids, and you know, you're going to get 72 virgins when you go up, and you know, the problem is, it's the clerics who, in other words, the problem with, what I find the problem with what's going on is, it's many times, is in fact, that's what they point out in this week's parasha. Why was Sodom and Amorah, like, in this week's parasha, Avram prays the 10 righteous people, and he says no, and he destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. But the commentator's point, there are many nations just as bad. So how come then they did the same thing? Do we know what the difference was? The difference was is in the other lands, the laws on the books were ethical, but no one for the people weren't. But in Sodom is they legalized. Don't have to look too far, Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. When the famous story, I say Kristallnacht, when they were breaking the glasses and burning down and the fire engine standing there, they said, why don't you put them out? I said, the law says we can't. In other words, when you legalize it, that's the biggest evil. And that's why Sodom and Gomorrah would work, because It was legalizing evil. If one, okay, so people are evil. So I'm saying you find among other nations you have evil people. Everyone has them. We have, and then the leaders, they condemn the act. Okay, so what could you do? You know, and if it's a minority, you know, if you have a majority doing it, you have to wonder. But at least openly, you condemn it. But when you have the clerics, the one who are firing them up, you got to ask yourself, what do you mean Islam is a peaceful religion? What does that mean? It's a meaningless statement. If the religion might be peace, if the people are killing people, I don't know, it doesn't help us that it's a peaceful religion. The problem is it's the clerics who are worse. In fact, that we could actually, there's this discussion of that in this week's parasha also called Yishmael. It comes from Para Adam. It says, in other words, the Koach, the difference between the Christians, the commentators go into, that's a separate class on that. But that's what they talk about. That's the danger is legalizing evil. You know, you have criminals, so some get away with it, you put them in jail. And basically, it's an ethical society. But when the law is no guest, you get to rape the people, then it's a big problem. And that's when it becomes the law. That's the biggest evil. So that's why Sodom and Amora, Nazi Germany, were the worst, because the law was the evil. Okay, have a good night.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you.
Yeah, nice to
Maybe we'll be
you.
Seeing you in the future.
Yes.